intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, happy Friday, everyone. Here we are on the ninth day of April in the year 2021, a year that will resonate throughout history as the year of insanity. I am pretty darn confident of that. I'm Mike Gaddy, and we are here today with our program called Dare to Think Out Loud. I dare you to think quietly, but that seems to be an issue for most people. They would much rather feel their way through life than to actually engage their brain and think their way through life. We're here today to kind of upset those people as much as possible. And as old Waylon Jennings once said, I've always been crazy, but it keeps me from going insane. Welcome today to my good producer from down south of the equator, Dave Scorpio. Dave, how you doing today, partner?
Hey, Mr. Mike Gaddy, I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right in this crazy, crazy world where everything is inverted, just like your introduction says.
Oh, well, thanks, Dave. Would you be so kind as to tell the people how they can support Revolution Radio and the free thought? What we actually provide for the people is provided by Revolution Radio, the ability to think for yourself.
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, people need to remember to think, to dare to think out loud. And, not many other platforms would allow a show like yours, Mike, with the information that you bring forth and so many other shows here on the network. You know, free speech really is under attack. Our rulers don't want us to be able to speak our mind or think our mind. So everybody come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Come aboard and become a Patreon member. Give what you can to keep this platform of free speech going. There's also a Zazzle store that you can buy stuff from. And there's t-shirts, all kinds of cool stuff that helps support the network. Or you can scroll down at the bottom of the front page, and there's an actual physical address where you can mail in donations the old-fashioned way. So, guys, come aboard and keep this train going. It's a unique place here. Everyone that listens already knows that. So come aboard and help us out. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave. We surely appreciate that. And out there in western Arizona resides my good friend and fellow compatriot in freedom, Cal Robbins. And Cal,
good morning.
How's things going out there, buddy?
No, things are going good out here. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Dave. It's good to be back on the air with you guys again this week. Looking forward to today's show.
Well, thank you, buddy. I think you and I were talking before we came on air, and I was saying as I was going over my documentation in preparation for this program this week, going over my source documents is where I like to bring my points from. Going over my source documents, I was found that that all of them are over 100 years old. So when we wonder why the American people are so dumbed down and do not really understand exactly how their government is supposed to work and how they've embraced a tyrannical government, maybe it's because for 100 years they haven't been told the truth. I believe that's very possible. And one of the things in preparing for today's program also, I thought, how do you break this down to digestible form to get people to understand it? And the reason I think that's important is because that's the way I had to approach it. I had to do this thing in small bites 30 plus years ago, because if you took it all of a sudden that everything you've been taught is basically a lie, it's a little hard to swallow. And I understand the people who get upset and go, oh, no. Well, but the point of it is, if all you have to cite as your belief, as your opinion, if all you have to cite is what you were taught using the 10th plank of the Communist Manifesto, you can't expect it to be truthful. And we look around today and we are terribly upset, or at least we claim we are, at least so many people, about what's happening now, how we've got the president making executive orders bypassing Congress. And so my question is, where is that power listed in the Constitution? But more importantly, where is the power the people have to prevent it? You have no, there's nothing the people can do to prevent the usurpation of their rights through the government. And guess what? It was planned that way from the beginning. So, you know, we stop and think about, you know, the people who are presently in control of this government. And we go, wow, we've got, Dr. Fauci, who was not elected. And Fauci has been under both Republican and Democrats. And he is obviously dictating policy. There is nothing in the Constitution that allows him to dictate policy. Executive orders are not law, but try to get the courts to agree with you on that, the federal courts. It was designed that way from the beginning. So the people today, the wealthy aristocracy, the Jeff Bezos, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Bill Gates, these multi-billionaires, these people who are dictating policy in this country, are the same segment of society in 1787 that sought to get rid of the Articles of Confederation because they were too restrictive, and to change the form of government to a government which gave them unlimited powers. And, you know, people today, we have been taught for 100 years that, oh, the Constitution was inspired by God. No, it wasn't. Not unless you consider a rich man, a wealthy and well-born person, the aristocracy, to be your God. That would be the issue. That is where the problem would be for sure. So we had a form of government in 1787. we had a constitution called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. We had that. That was in place. That was the operative doctrine. That was the operative law. That was the law of the land in 1787. And the Federalists, and we're going to get into who were the Federalists here in just a minute, but did they form a conspiracy to change the form of government? Did the people who brought on this pandemic today create a conspiracy to bring forth more control for the people who want to control others? Did that happen way back then? Well, the Articles of Confederation stated very clearly that no two or more states shall enter into any treaty, confederation, or alliance, whatever between them, without the consent of the United States and Congress assembled, specifying absolutely the purposes for which the same is to be entered into and how long it shall continue. That was Article 6 of the Articles of Confederation. This is why the Federalists tried to surround the proposed Constitution with an air of legality by stating in the preamble, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, etc. The specified time limit was perpetual. Thus, the title Perpetual Union to Secure the Blessings of Liberty to Ourselves and Our Posterity. Pardon me. But Congress had not authorized any such treaty, confederation, or alliance as the Federalists formed. The conspirators knew it, especially the man who made the coup possible, George Washington. More than most men, commented historian Gary Wills, he showed an early and unblinking awareness that the Philadelphia Convention would engage in acts not only irregular or extra legal, but very likely completely illegal. John Jay alerted Washington to this problem in January of 1787, stating, Jay's fears were only partially, allayed somewhat in February when Congress authorized the convention. But Congress only authorized amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Congress did not authorize a new constitution. So the Federalists were operating out of the boundaries of the law. And my question has always been, can you complete a legal act with an illegal act? Can you do something totally illegal to create something legal? And that is, I believe, is the question. But on March the 10th of 1787, Washington wrote to Jay, and his quote was, "In strict propriety, a convention so holden may not be legal." So they knew what they were doing was probably not legal, but they did it anyway. In actuality, they knew the whole thing was illegal, a subversive act of revolution. Half of them were lawyers. They had to know the law. Blackstone, and they also knew Blackstone, which was referenced quite a bit during that period of time. Blackstone had commented on the convention parliament that had, brought in William III to the throne in 1688 and 1689 by saying that William III had been legal because the throne was unoccupied. So someone moving in where the throne is unoccupied has the legality, the legal standing to create a new form if the throne was not occupied. That's a reference. And so Blackstone wrote that the vacancy of the throne was precedent to their meeting without any royal summons, and it was not a consequence of it. But the American throne was occupied in 1787. We had a Congress. We had a Constitution. Congress had not abdicated their powers. There is no record of Congress abdicating their powers whatsoever. Delegates of several states had been issued writs by their state legislatures. These writs expressly prohibited the substitution of a new constitutional document. Those who came to Philadelphia for any purpose were conspirators. Yet most of those who came to Philadelphia had a death sentence in their pockets against the existing Confederation and also a death sentence against the sitting Congress. Because with their act in Philadelphia, they did away with the sitting Congress of the United States. They just wiped it out. Imagine today, just put on your little imagination thought and think that if Bezos, Gates, Fauci, Zuckerberg, and 26 lawyers from inside the Beltway all decided to hold a private convention where they would overthrow the present government of the United States and create their own government. How many of you would be up for that? In essence, people, that's what happened in 1787. It was this well-organized conspiracy that had control over the institutional levers that made possible the events of the Revolutionary War era that transformed the entire political and social structure of the 13 colonies in less time than it now takes to send a First Amendment case from appeal to the Supreme Court. So here is a question. Well, before I get to that question, Cal, you got any comments on what I've said so far? Anything to add? I'm sure you've got some very cognitive things to add there.
No, I've got things, but I'm waiting for you to finish your point on this one. You're on a roll, Mike. Keep going.
Okay, buddy. Well, you know, you would ask yourself, who are the Federalists? You know, we're told about the Federalist Papers, and we study the Federalist Papers. We don't study the Anti-Federalist Papers. Most of us never heard of them in school, but we sure heard of the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers presented one point of view. They did not take into consideration. It was a marketing effort. These three people had just been involved in overthrowing the sitting government of the United States, James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton in Philadelphia. So they needed to do a marketing campaign to convince the people that they weren't criminals. Just like the people today who are telling us they're going to take our guns through executive order and everything else. It's a very similar situation. But who were the Federalist Party? Who were the members of the Federalist Party? Well, let's go no farther than the Federalists themselves. Let's try John Adams, for instance. John Adams said that the Federalist Party was the party of the education, the talents, the virtues, and the property of the country. That's pretty good. And there's one other thing to stop and think about when you read, you know, you have to get a lay of the land when you're studying this history. And when you read what was happening back in 1787, when the Federalists referred to a democracy and they talked down a democracy, we're well aware of that. They despised a democracy. But what was a democracy? A democracy at that time was a form of government where the people had a say-so over the actions of their government. The sovereignty in a democracy rests with the people. Now, there's always the tyranny of the majority, which we experience in a lot of ways, but a democracy was the people controlling the government. Not the other way around. But the Federalist Party did not believe in democracy, which had been made possible under the Articles of Confederation. In the convention of 1787, Edmund Randolph explained that the framers of the Articles of Confederation were indeed wise and great men, but that, and I quote, human rights were the chief knowledge of the time. Wait a minute. What did he say? Human rights were the chief knowledge of the time and were instrumental in the creation of the Articles. Wow. So the Articles of Confederation were there to protect the rights of the people, their human rights. Didn't say political rights or civil rights. It said the human rights of the people. And since then, Randolph said, and I quote, our chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our Constitution. It is a maxim, which I hold incontrovertible, that the powers of government exercised by the people themselves swallows up the other branches. None of the constitutions have provided sufficient checks against the democracy. What he's saying is no constitution has provided a sufficient check against the people's rights. The feeble Senate of Virginia is a phantom. Maryland has a more powerful Senate, but the late distractions in that state have discovered that it is not powerful enough. The check established in the Constitution of New York and Massachusetts is yet a stronger barrier against democracy or against the people, but they all seem insufficient. Now, for those of you, that comes from Max Farron, the records of the Federal Convention of 1787, first volume, pages 26 through 27, for those who would like to verify what I have said. So we have here them especially talking about they need to restrict the rights of the people for their government. They need to restrict the human rights of the people for their government. Now, can you now understand why when they got to the Constitutional Convention, the Federalists voted unanimously by state to not include a Bill of Rights? Does it begin to make a little bit of sense now? They wanted a new government that would restrict the rights of the people to govern themselves. That was the purpose of the Constitutional Convention. I know that's a little tough for people to swallow, but the facts are irrefutable. Alexander Hamilton himself was in profound agreement with Edmund Randolph, and his statements at the Constitutional Convention are equally illuminating of the character and purpose of the Federalist Party. Freely and openly, Alexander Hamilton declared himself in favor of a government by the rich and the well-born, and in the use of force to suppress the mass of the people when he said, when they will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice. Well, who gets to apply that? John Jay did not elaborate his beliefs to the same extent as his fellow Federalists, but he contented himself with his favorite maxim that he repeated on multiple occasions when he said, the people who own this country should govern it. Okay, that comes out of John Jay's papers, for those of you who like to check sources. So he said that himself. And that was actually, you can find it in a book which was published in 1935 by Frank Monaghan and John Jay, in a biography of John Jay, and you would find that on page 323. Now, the Federalists, just like they do, they created, just like we're going through today, the Federalists created a PSYOP. They didn't know it by that name back then, but they knew the dynamics. They had to create a psychological operation which would convince the people to follow their dictates. We're right in the middle of a massive PSYOP right now. Masks, social distancing, vaccines. All of this is a mass PSYOP. The same thing was done in 1787. And to just to show that my basis for that, let's look at several things. The Federalist propaganda, which culminated in the Federalist Papers, actually began prior to the convention. And they did this in the media of the day. Imagine that. Items with a tinge of special pleading began to appear before the convention actually met and continued throughout its deliberations. and burst forth in full strength once the Constitution was presented in the electorate, or to the electorate, I'm sorry. A few examples, and I will provide them for you. May 16, 1787, the Pennsylvania Gazette pictured Congress as the object of total derision. Oh, well, we're going to tell you in the newspaper that Congress is absolutely useless. They're not doing their jobs, but then we have an offer for you after we tell you they're terrible. So then, May 23rd, in the same paper, it stated that it was unanimously agreed that a strong executive power should be lodged somewhere and predicted chaos unless something were done. Go back a few months. Weren't we told the same thing about the election? That there would be utter chaos if we didn't get some good Marxists to run this government? Didn't say it in that language, but that's what they were saying. While the convention itself was in session, a serious effort was made to prepare the public mind to accept the work of the Federalists without question. Two lines of argument much used in the media of the day was one. Let's see. Let me get my papers together here. Okay. That. Let's see. Make sure I got. I'm sorry about that, folks. Make sure I've got everything set here. But anyway, they kept the line going over and over and over again. And so we had the points being made that these men were doing great work. These were the most brilliant men in America. They were doing great work. They were coming up with the great form of government, and it should be honored. Once they're finished, it should be honored just because it was these great people who prepared it. We're going back to the Nancy Pelosi deal. Let's just pass this thing so we can find out what these wonderful people put in it. Now, haven't we heard that same thing today? So let's look at that period of time in 1787. Where was the wealth centered in this country? It was centered in the seaport towns. That's where it was. It was in these port towns, and also in the South, it was where the huge planters were. So, as I was saying, the members of the convention were the wisest and the best men in the country. Therefore, their deliberations should be accepted without question. If their deliberations were not accepted, chaos would ensue. Opponents of the convention were said to be inspired only by ulterior motives. Pennsylvania Gazette, July 25th and August the 8th of 15. On August the 29th, the Pennsylvania Gazette held forth in a manner since made familiar by use in political campaigns, including the one we're dealing with now. The pulse of industry, ingenuity, and enterprise in every art and occupation of man stands still, awaiting the results of the convention. September 5th, the Gazette stated that every state had its Shays, who was trying to do what Shays had done in Massachusetts. On September 12th, there were predictions of future horrors to be suffered if the as-yet unseen Constitution were not adopted. Such propaganda did not fool all of the people, naturally. A brilliant answer to that was found in Brutus Jr. I won't take the time to read that, but you can find that on the internet, one of the few things that's still left. The acceptance of the Federalist propaganda as fact has not always been the consequence of ignorance. So it was accepted. Newspapers actually printed fake letters from Daniel Shays. Fake media, fake news. How interesting is that? Well, you want to jump in for a while, Cal?
Well, when we started this, you know, when you proposed what we were going to talk about, you know, I went to what are the arguments against the Articles of Confederation? And if you ask anybody, you know, what's wrong with the Articles of Confederation, they'll answer you, but how many of those people have actually ever even read the Articles of Confederation? I mean, most people seem to be parroting what they've been told, not, you know, by someone else's opinion, and haven't even read the Articles of Confederation for themselves to make their own judgment.
Well, Cal, I know that you know this, but, you know, I've asked some people just as, you know, I asked a lady last night when I was walking my dogs. Her son is really into history, and so we were talking about some points, and her son happened to be there, and he is in a local high school. And I said to both of them, I said, not to put you on the spot, but could you guys, how many members of the Constitutional Convention of 1787 can you guys name? And the lady, and she's no dummy, the lady, she's a professional, the lady says, well, you know, when I think about it, I can only name three. And I said, okay, what three were those? And she said, well, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and Patrick Henry. I said, well, ma'am, you got one out of three. And she said, really? And I said, yes. And I said, and you have a college degree? And she said, yes, but I don't ever remember even discussing who the delegates to the convention were. And I said, well, you don't think that would be important? Who the delegates were? Well, the economic and political nexus of the Federalists were located in the sea coast areas, as I mentioned before, and in the industrial cities of the North, and with the planters in the South, and also, of course, the merchants in the North. Okay, when it comes to the delegates to the Pennsylvania convention, the delegates to the convention in Pennsylvania in 1787, guys, how many of the eight delegates from Pennsylvania, where were those eight delegates from?
Philadelphia.
All eight of them from one city. Do you think the people of Pennsylvania, out in western Pennsylvania, where the people were an agrarian society, trying to make a living, working day to day, do you think they were represented at the Constitutional Convention? Let's look at South Carolina. All of the delegates from South Carolina, where were they from, Cal?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure they're all around one of the seaboard towns.
They were all from Charleston.
Charleston, then, yeah.
Do you think upcountry South Carolina was represented at the Constitutional Convention?
No.
What we had was exactly what Alexander Hamilton said they wanted: the wealthy and the well-born. During the colonial period, prior to the Revolutionary War, this ruling aristocracy, which arose, kept itself in power by a number of political weapons. As wealth accumulated and concentrated along the coast, as the frontier moved westward from coast and became deader and alien in character to these people, and as the propertyless element in colonial towns grew larger, the possessors of property, or the people of wealth and well-born, as Hamilton called them, demanded a political interpretation of the government in their favor. Imagine that. They demanded political supremacy in order to protect their property from the economic programs of what they referred to as debtor agrarians and the town poor. They did not want these people to have an equal vote in government with them, because they considered themselves, as Washington wrote to John Jay, you know, we are the, you know, we have a right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience. His letter is represented by these people exactly. So colonial wealth, encouraged by the British government itself, gradually secured the political safeguards it demanded. The possession of a certain amount of property became the prerequisite of the absolute right to vote. Now, we've talked about this. Most people didn't know this. About 4 to 5 to 6% maximum of the people in the United States, something like 3,700,000 back then, about 5 to 6% maximum were able to vote for the very first Congress. Now, is that we the people? If those were the only people who got to vote were wealthy landowners, you know, of course, blacks didn't get to vote. Females didn't get to vote. And if you didn't own property, you couldn't vote. And this government was created that way. Did they create the government for the people who had no representation, or did they create the government for themselves? Dave, you got any thoughts so far?
Well, Mike, you know, it's interesting. I used to wonder when this culture of corruption was created with the federal government. And one of the things for certain, your research really helps answer that question, because it turns out it started at the very beginning by creating a constitution that it wasn't even sent there to create, that actually took away rights, not, you know, giving more rights, which is, of course, what all government ever ends up doing. And my other thought is about the, you know, the port cities and their functions in history. And we see this same kind of use of the major port cities. This is where, you know, these are sort of the hotbeds in today's world of, you know, so-called progressivism, like, you know, Seattle and Portland. And oftentimes these cities represent the entire state, and leaving all the rural people without any representation whatsoever.
Well, I totally agree. And just for you people who are fact checkers, I know you don't work for Amazon because they don't know what they're doing. Oh, I mean, Facebook. I'm sorry about that. Or Amazon either, for that moment. But here are my references for what I just read about where the delegates were from and everything else. And these come from a book called The Revolutionary Movement in Pennsylvania, 1760 to 1776. That book was written in 1901 by a C.H. Lincoln. Okay, my other reference would be a book called The History of Political Parties in the Province of New York, 1760 to 1776. A book that was published by Carl Becker in 1909. And then another book I use for reference, A.M. Schlesinger, The Colonial Merchants and the American Revolution, 1763 to 1776. That book is newer. It was published in 1918. Now, other sources that bring up these same points, which we are never taught, was a book by J.T. Adams called Revolutionary New England, 1691 to 1776. Now, that one was published in 1923, so it's a little less than 100 years old. Edith A. Bailey, Influences Toward Radicalism in Connecticut, was published by Smith College Studies in History in 1916. So I have a whole list of references should anyone want them. So what I am talking about today is not my opinion. So if you want to challenge you want to challenge my facts with your opinion, then get you some sources and let's talk. Because what you have heard on TV, what you have read in history books for the past 50 to 60 years is pure bunk. So the problem that was originating was the ever-growing western part of this country prior to 1787 and after 1787 found it impossible for them to politically overcome the minority control of the East by any constitutional means whatsoever. So any points, anything you want to bring up about that, Cal?
Well, you brought up about the agrarian laws and all that, and Henry Knox mentions it to George Washington when Henry Knox was setting Washington up to be chosen as a delegate to the convention. And it comes from a letter dated October 23rd, 1786. And this is Knox saying to Washington, talking about the Shay, it says, "Their creed is that the property of all the United States has been protected from confiscation of Britain by joint exertions of all," meaning everybody's put into winning this war, "and therefore ought to be the common property of all." Now we haven't even addressed the land speculators part of all of this yet. And he that attempts opposition to this creed is an enemy to equity and justice. In other words, if you're not for this, then you're against the people's rights to own property and ought to be swept from the face of the earth. In other words, they are determined to annihilate all debts, public and private, and have agrarian laws, which are easily affected by the means of unfunded paper, which shall be a tender in all cases whatsoever. In other words, the people of Western Massachusetts, the Shays, had felt that they'd earned that property. That was their property, and it was being stolen from them by the government of Massachusetts. And they were just rising up against it. So it'd have to be a detailed study of the Shays' Rebellion to really understand it, and how the Shays' Rebellion was used as an excuse for the Constitutional Convention.
Well, exactly, and that's a very valid point. Would you agree or disagree with the following statement, guys? "Traditionally, in the history of the United States, the Articles of Confederation have played the role of a villain. Historians old and new have pictured them as the product of inexperience, the parent of chaos, and the basic cause of the need for the creation of a new constitution in 1787. In so interpreting the first constitution of the United States in the history of the country during its existence, historians have tended to follow the lead of the Federalist." In other words, the Federalists have dictated history. "Federalist Party was organized to destroy a constitution which embodied the ideals of government and economic practice abhorrent to those elements in American society of which the Federalist Party was the total political expression." Any thoughts on that statement?
A valid assessment.
Any thoughts, Dave?
Yeah, that's a good assessment. Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, and I don't know how many times in my studies and in my conversations with people, I've heard this said over and over again. They go, well, I say, why did we need a new constitution? Well, the Articles of Confederation were weak. I'd say, which part? And then it's stone silence. Because what those people are doing is repeating something like I just read. They have heard in history that the Articles were weak, but they can't tell you why they were weak. They accepted something that someone else said, maybe in a classroom, maybe in a book, that they were weak. Now, the proponents of government have always had the resources to get people to write history books, to write papers favoring government. And that's why I believe, as Sheldon Richman once said, the Constitution was a revolution in favor of government. And the facts are there to prove it. "Historians who have viewed the American Revolution from the vantage point of the internal history of the American colonies have seen the significance of the social struggle going on and its relation to the outbreak of the revolution. But the conclusions to be drawn from the history of social conflict within the colonies and applied to such matters of mutual concern in the new states as the writing of a common constitution are seldom drawn and applied." In other words, as people look at this, they do not realize that the political struggle was the same as we're having today. We have a political struggle between the people who profit from government and the people who have to pay for it. And that has been an eternal struggle. But the thing that has always amazed me, and it's amazing me now, guys, is how are the people who are forced to pay for this government so enamored with that government? A government which robs from them the product of their own work, their own labor. Takes anywhere from 40 to 60% of everybody's wages who actually works in all forms of taxation. So why, and you guys, why do people continue to support that?
Well, Mike, that's a great point about the people that have to pay for it. It's really incredible. You know, if you fast forward to today, we have a government that's literally spending money, trillions of dollars at a time. Biden's already racking up, what, $4 trillion. And that's just a small part of the overall budget. Not long ago, the entire federal budget was less than $2 trillion. And so we're seeing a sort of a cancerous beast that's rapidly going out of control.
Mike?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Well, one of the arguments is that the Articles of Confederation were weak and were limited. But if you look at it, under the Articles of Confederation, the government was limited from taxing the people directly. The Constitution delegated the power to the government to tax the people directly. You tell me which one is stronger in defending the people.
Well, that is a no-brainer, because in the studies, or as we're looking at them, looking at the Articles of Confederation, you know, I was making that point to a friend this morning, that the Articles of Confederation provided what most people today say we need in government. Term limits, control over taxation. The Articles of Confederation had immediate recall. The Articles of Confederation, again, the Articles of Confederation were written to protect the human rights of the people. The Constitution of 1787 was to destroy those and to put everything in the power of government. And as I mentioned to you, Cal, looking at one of those courses on the Federalist Papers on Amazon Prime, the lectures, those great courses, they openly admit under the Federalists that the Federalists created a government that would allow the government to be the arbiter of its own powers. And boy, are we seeing that today. No wonder if people have been taught that the Federalists were the go-to all-knowing people and that they created a government which would decide its own powers. Today, as we see Biden just circumventing Congress and doing whatever the hell he wants to with executive orders, we now see that he is the culmination of the Federalist intent. They're deciding their own powers. It doesn't have anything to do with you. And if Biden passes some of these, gets these executive orders out there and starts restricting gun ownership, do you people really believe for a minute that the federal courts are going to support you against the government? Won't happen.
Yeah, Mike, the culmination of Federalist intent, that's a great statement there. Very well said.
Well, thank you.
Monarchy Hamilton wanted.
Yes, you know, and, you know, I asked some folks the other day, have you ever heard of John Francis Mercer? And you get this deer in the headlights look. Well, John Francis Mercer published a list. He was a delegate from the youngest delegate from the state of Maryland. And he published a list of 20 people at the convention who spoke openly about their desire for a monarchy. 20. They spoke openly about it. And when on June the 18th of 1787, Alexander Hamilton made a pitch for a total monarchy, according to Max Farrand and the notes from the Constitutional Convention, James Madison says, oh gosh, Hamilton let the cat out of the bag. Well, how would you interpret that, Cal? Hamilton let the cat out of the bag. Would that indicate to you that the Federalists knew what they wanted, but they were trying to keep it moderated to a point that the people might accept it, and Hamilton just opened up and let the cat out of the bag?
Well, that's exactly what happened. The Federalists wanted a power of a monarchy.
Well, let's look at one of our good buddies that most people, again, have never heard of, and that's Gouverneur Morris, not Governor Morris, but Gouverneur Morris. And people wonder many times, where did that first name come from? That name Gouverneur was the maiden name of Gouverneur Morris's mother. But Morris was a strong Federalist, and he explained that the ruling aristocracy had fooled the masses over long periods of time, and that the masses were beginning to wake up. And that was why they needed a new constitution. If the attempt to deceive were continued, he wrote, farewell aristocracy. Oh, so he's saying if we allow these people to continue to wake up, there goes our aristocracy. There goes the government of the rich and well-born. So we need a constitution. And they got it in 1787.
That's Gouverneur Morris, who wrote the preamble and who inserted the necessary and proper clause, correct?
Well, that's
the same guy.
And Sunday night, DW and I are going to get into another part of this, but let's go ahead and make that point. Is that during the Constitutional Convention, Gouverneur Morris proposed a contracts clause for the Constitution to the Committee of the Whole. The Committee of the Whole voted down the contracts clause. So while being the scrivener for the Committee of Style and Arrangement, Gouverneur Morris put it back in. So how many people are aware? And people, I promise you, if all you think your history is what you were taught in school, high school or college, and you haven't done the research, you have been deceived, because they don't teach this. But it's in the National Archives. It's in the letters between the founders. And Cal, if I may be so bold, could I call you my disciple?
Sure.
How much, prior to when we first started communicating, how many source documents had you actually read?
Oh, maybe 15 or 20.
And since then,
hundreds, every day almost sometimes, it's a new rabbit hole you've got me running down, chasing down source documents, and it's fun.
Well, do the source documents support the history that we're taught in school?
No, it's almost 180 degrees opposite.
So could you say that the whole program around, or would you say, not could you say, would you say that the whole program around the Constitution being this great, inspired by God, piece of legislation or piece of a constitution, whatever you want to call it, would you say that that belief is part of a massive psyop?
Definitely. That's been, you know, I've studied history beyond U.S. history, and that's been a prevalent theme throughout the history of man, is for government and religion to tie themselves together to control the people. Either the government will control the people, or religion will control the people, or they'll work in concert together to control the people.
Well, one of the things that amazes me in these older documents reading about this era, they refer to the conservatives. And today, conservatives is considered a good thing in some people's mind, not mine, but it is considered a good thing in many people's mind because people just love to hang their hat on that. Well, I'm a conservative. Yeah, well, what are you conserving? Well, I don't know what you mean. Well, I'm a conservative. Well, the Federalists called themselves conservatives. What did they call the Anti-Federalists? Radicals. So they were playing name games way back then.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
They were the conservatives. And that's what they referred themselves, you know. But again, Morris, and we're not taught that Morris put the contracts clause back into the Constitution. Well, you know, it was about 15 years later that the Supreme Court would make a huge decision based on the contracts clause. Imagine that. And in that decision, the Supreme Court said it's okay to bribe a state legislature. Tune in Sunday night for more details. So, in what world would the federal court say it's okay to bribe a state legislature? Coming back on the other side, folks, thanks for tuning in to Dare to Think.
Unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
A warrior or a victim? Every time I hear those words, it gives me cold chills. That is, in so many ways, a warrior or a victim is the very essence of where we are today. You can wear a mask, you can socially distance, you can get your vaccine and be a victim. Or you can just say no to tyranny and become a warrior. It's really that simple. But I'm sure most people prefer comfort. Comfort's not going to last for very long. But getting back to our subject today, and welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud. And one of the things I found in my studies and deep dive into these documents was that prior to and sometimes during the Revolutionary War, there were people who we call Federalists who were really monarchist, who didn't really want to split from England because their fortunes were tied up with the king. And as I said before, Gouverneur Morris says, farewell aristocracy. And he said, if the disputes with Great Britain continue, we shall be under the worst of all possible dominions. We shall be under the domination of a riotous mob. What could the aristocracy do to save itself? This is before the Revolutionary War is over, people. Morris had an answer to his own question, and he said, it is the interest of all men, therefore, to seek for reunion with our parent state. Now, for those of you who like documentation, that's a letter from Gouverneur Morris to Mr. Penn, New York, May the 20th, 1774, found in the American Archives. Washington, 1837 to 1853, the fourth set, serial one, page 343. So Morris did say that. Morris thus saw what others were not to see for at least a year, or even for maybe 2 years, namely that the connection with Britain was the guarantee of the aristocratic order within the colonies. The growing awareness of that fact does much to explain the attitude of the conservatives, or federalists, do your name switch there, toward the idea of independence and toward the idea of a common government once independence could not be avoided. When Alexander Graydon returned to Philadelphia in 1776, he found that many of those who had formerly been much in favor of liberty and Whiggism, as he referred to it, they were no longer so ardent in their beliefs. The reason he came up with was, and I quote, power to use a language which had already ceased to be orthodox and could therefore only be whispered had fallen into the hands of the lower class. It was, in fact, just beginning to be perceived that the ardor of the inflamed multitude is not to be tempered, and that the instigators of revolution are rarely those who are destined to conclude them or profit by them. Unquote. Independence was thus seen as these conservatives as an evil of which internal discord and revolution seem to be an inevitable twin. We do not want to be independent, wrote Joseph Hughes, merchant of North Carolina and a delegate to the Congress. Quote, we want no revolution unless a change of ministry and measures would be deemed such, unquote. Feeling that way and faced with what seemed political ruin, the conservatives, Federalists, in the Second Continental Congress opposed every measure that smacked of independence. Now, when were you taught this? Led by John Dickinson, they sent a second petition to the king in the summer of 1775. Twice they rejected consideration of Benjamin Franklin's plan of confederation, even though it provided for reconciliation. They ignored John Adams' plea for the abolition of customs houses, the establishment of independent state governments, the formation of a confederation, and the opening of the ports of the colonies to the world. Furthermore, they took positive as well as negative action. Again, John Dickinson was their leader, this time in a movement to secure instructions from the colonial assemblies yet in control of the conservatives. Federalists. Instructions directing the delegates of those assemblies to vote against independence should the matter come up in Congress. Yeah, these Federalists were going to vote against independence if it affected them financially. The conservatives retained their control of Congress until February of 1776, when they met their first significant defeat. Then King George III declared, and I quote, the rebellious war now levied is now become more general and is manifestly carried on for the purpose of establishing an independent empire. At this notice from King George, the Federalists in Congress attempted to send an address to the colonies denying that independence was the purpose of their Congress. Congress voted this down and rejected the motion, which was written by James Wilson. James Wilson was a Federalist. He was at the convention. He proposed the Constitution. He didn't want a Bill of Rights. He was referred to as the Caledonian. He became a member of the first Supreme Court. Here was a man who had written a proposal in Congress to not seek independence because it was about to affect his pocketbook. He was a ruling Federalist. But then independence began to be talked of openly in Congress. And the radicals, the people who represented the people, demanded the appointment of a committee to prepare a confederation. The resolution that was offered was to the effect that the colonies had a right to make alliances with foreign powers. Soon the ports of the colonies were declared open to the world. Finally, on May 15, 1776, Congress passed what John Adams declared to be the most important resolution ever passed in America. What Congress did was to invite a revolution in those colonies, yet within the hands of the Federalists, conservatives. The radicals responded gladly. The government of Pennsylvania was toppled from its position, and the last bulwark of conservative opposition to independence was gone. The Federalists now had to choose between England and the United States, between loyalism and patriotism. Many became loyalists, as some had done before this time. Fearfully and reluctantly, the victims of circumstances, partly of their own creation, while others became revolutionists. Now, those conservatives who became revolutionists, whether willingly or not, did not throw away their ideals of a monarchical form of government. They were too cool, too long accustomed to government in their best interest to be led astray by any floods of radical propaganda. That is why Benjamin Rush said the ardent wish for liberty was a mental disease. Cal, you want to jump in here, buddy?
It kind of sounds like what we talked about last week is the Federalists saw that, you know, there was this growing urge for liberty and independence, and that's kind of opposition to everything they wanted. So what do? They led the opposition.
Yep. Very much so. These people, and I go back to John Francis Mercer, saying at least 20 of them at the Constitutional Convention were vying for a monarchy. Hamilton wanted a monarchy. And he openly expressed his desire for a monarchy. So how can we look at these Federalists today and think that they were writing a constitution to protect the rights of the people? Well, the thing about it is the conservatives or the Federalists then attempted to delay independence until a common government could be created. Now, have you ever thought about this? The war was officially over in 1783. And it took how long? You know, the very fact that Gouverneur and Robert Morris tried to delay the end of the war because they were getting filthy wealthy. Why end a war if you're making all this money? Could that be why America's been at war now for almost 20 years? In a general way, these conservative Federalists knew what kind of a government they wanted. They wanted a highly centralized government which would take the place of the British government, a government which would regulate trade, control the disposition of all the Western lands, and provide force to quell internal dissension. They did not need the experience of the Revolution to demonstrate what were for them the benefits of such a government. They had been stating their ideas on the subject since the meeting of the First Continental Congress. In that body, Joseph Galloway had argued in behalf of his plan of union that while the colonies denied the authority of Parliament, they were in their relations to one another in a perfect state of nature, and that conflict between colony and colony was at this moment only suppressed by the authority of Great Britain, and should that authority be weakened or annulled, many subjects of unsettled disputes, and which in that case can only be settled by an appeal to the sword, and must involve us all in the horrors of a civil war. The source of that is Joseph Galloway, Historical and Political Reflections on the Rise and Progress of the American Rebellion. Wow. That was written in 1780? Okay. Source document. Cal, you want to get into the land speculators a bit, sir?
Well, that would come up under, once again, Gouverneur Morris, right hand of Robert Morris, and that has to do with the foreign debt as opposed to the domestic debt. And one of the arguments against the Articles of Confederation was that the foreign debt that the debt was not being met, that they couldn't pay the debt. But In turning to the actually to the House of Representatives from the floor of the House on May 19, 1789, it stated that the foreign debt is being paid. So if there's a problem with the debt, it must be the domestic debt. And who is that domestic debt owed to but to the likes of the Federalists? So they're creating a government to make sure they get paid.
But we are told about all of the magnificent constitutional rights that we have. And this has to be from a people totally ignorant of their history. And again, I'm going to bring up my favorite quotes, Marcus Tullius Cicero: a people ignorant of their own history will be forever children. Maybe that's why these people are so easily led into masking and vaccines and social distancing and closing down their businesses and everything else, is because they are children obeying the orders of their parents. And their parent happens to be government. I guess that would be Joe Biden say, "I'm your daddy." But in a general way, the Federalists always knew what kind of government they wanted. They wanted a centralized government, you know, and they wanted a domineering form of government. So the conservatives also conceived of union as desirable for the purpose of making laws relative to the general policing of America. This would have a tendency of checking a turbulent spirit in any one of the colonies. Why do you think they didn't want the states to have any power? They wanted the federal government to be supreme over the states in all of their legislation. So if one state got the crazy idea that they were tired of this, or in 1860 when 11 states got the crazy idea they were tired of this government, you could use the powers that resided in the other states to use force to put them down. So that had been proposed way before. And that was in a letter, was actually indicated in a letter from Thomas Wharton to Thomas Walpole in May the 2nd of 1774. The idea of a central government as a check on the democracy of colonial legislatures had been urged all through the 18th century, according to Richard Frothingham in his book, The Rise of the Republic of the United States, which was published in 1910. Cal or Dave, do you see any significance that these documents that talk about the truth of our history are 100 years old and no one is citing from them in any modern historical works?
Well, it's very significant because after 80 some odd years, even people had completely forgotten what the purpose of government was. I mean, this 11 states that seceded did exactly what the colonies did, and the people had forgotten that that is a natural right. They'd forgotten that maxim. That's one of the bases of liberty.
Well, I was looking at, again, at my source documents, and I was looking at a letter from Edward Biddle, B-I-D-D-L-E. And in that letter, he states, and I quote, "The subjugation of my country I deprecate as a most grievous calamity, and yet sicken at the idea of 13 unconnected, petty democracies. If we are to be independent, let us, in the name of God, at once have an empire and place Washington at its head." So this, when we think that these people were really had liberty, like Patrick Henry, in their minds and hearts, they're totally wrong. But let's go to Richard Henry Lee, one of my favorites of the founders. And on June the 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moved in Congress that the colonies were and of a right ought to be free and independent states, and that they should form a confederation, and that committees should be appointed to draw up the documents that can, and guess what? Let me read that again. Richard Henry Lee made a motion that the colonies were and of a right ought to be free and independent states, and that they should form a confederation, and that committee should be drawn, appointed to draw up the documents for that confederation. And it was opposed by the Federalists all the way back in 1776. They opposed it back then. It's just, they said they did not object to the formation of a confederation or the formulation of a plan for a treaty with France, but from their point of view, the only reason offered for declaring independence was the reason of a madman. So declaring independence to the Federalist was the reasoning of a madman. They said independence would only render the colonies ridiculous in the eyes of foreign powers who would not unite with the colonies before they had united themselves under a central power. Likewise, daily experience showed that the inhabitants of every colony consider themselves at liberty to do as they please upon almost every occasion. And they decided John Dickinson, Robert L. Livingston, James Wilson, Edward Rutledge, and James Duane to do all in their power to stop this type of madness. So freedom was madness to these people.
Wow, that's fascinating, Mike. And we see the same line of thinking continuing today in earnest. And, you know, Mike, I was wondering, could you possibly sketch out what do you think a government would have looked like if we simply had the Articles of Confederation? I mean, is there a way to maybe describe what that might have looked like?
Well, number one is the rich would not control the government. And the people would have a say-so in their own governing. We think we do now because we call it a constitutional republic. And as Cal pointed out the other day, Cal, how many people had constitutional republics? Uh-oh. Cal must have taken a break. But we were talking about...
No, I forgot to mute. No, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. China is a constitutional republic. North Korea is a constitutional republic. The former Soviet Union was a constitutional republic. So being a constitutional republic doesn't necessarily guarantee liberty or freedom.
Germany had a constitution.
Yeah. It's,
oh, yeah. The devil's in the details, isn't it, guys?
Oh, big time. And again, we have been given this pablum, and I talk about it as pablum because it's like you feed the children to get them to do what you want them to do. This distorted history is over and over and over again. But, you know, here we couldn't allow the people to have the liberty to do as they please. That could not be allowed. And the Federalists said as much. John Dickinson, Robert L. Livingston, James Wilson, Edward Rutledge, and James Duane, as I said before, all too, you know, they changed. Consideration of the question was thus delayed until July the 1st of 1776, when John Dickinson made a formal speech in which he set forth the Federalist views for the last time before the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. He pleaded once more the necessity of union before independence and pointed to the difficulties of the committee engaged in the preparation of Articles of Confederation. In particular, he urged the necessity of a central power to control the western lands. That's where all the land speculators were. Once independence was declared, the conservatives continued to hope for the establishment of a supreme national legislature. There is no clearer statement of this desire than that by Joseph Reed, at the time the private secretary to George Washington. He was still in hopes of reconciliation with England and King George, but he was for a national union among the 13 states in any case. Mere local authority should be subservient to the supreme decision of Congress. Imagine that. The conservatives had an opportunity of sorts to create the government they desired, for they dominated the committee which prepared the first draft of the Articles of Confederation. It was presented to Congress in the handwriting of John Dickinson. To a degree, this first draft of the Articles of Confederation was an expression of the conservative desire for a central government superior to the states. In the committee, they made a strenuous effort to destroy provincial distinctions, or in other words, the states, and to make everything of the most minute kind bend to what they call the good of the whole. But the draft presented to Congress did not contain many practical measures for the achievement of this purpose. Various reasons may be assigned for that failure. The two radicals on the committee doubtless exercised influence. More important was the fact that the Southern conservatives, or Southern Federalists, were obsessed with a fear of a New England-controlled government. They were convinced that a national government would subject the whole country to the rule of the New England junta. Probably the greatest restraint upon the work of the committee was the realization that most of the state governments would never knowingly accept a superior government over them. Any comments, Cal?
Well, yeah, the states wouldn't allow a government to be superior over them, which is exactly why when the Constitution was sent out for ratification, it was sent out to the people and not to the state legislatures. The state governments wouldn't have allowed it.
Absolutely. That's a very valid point. Well, in spite of the obstacles in the way of nationalism, the Dickinson draft of the first Articles of Confederation gave to Congress power over what was probably the most important subject of controversy at the time, the western lands and state boundaries. Speculators. We're really going to get into that Sunday night. Who were the land speculators? Congress was given power to limit the size of states, to define their boundaries, and to settle disputes over rival land claims. The grant of power was the most bitterly contested issue during the writing and ratification of the Articles of Confederation, something no one ever discusses, is the ratification of the Articles of Confederation. States with definite western boundaries like Maryland and Pennsylvania were in bitter opposition to states like Virginia, whose land claims were vast and went all the way to the Mississippi River. The landless states wanted to share in the profits expected from future sales. Their speculators wanted their pre-revolutionary land claims honored. They also feared the domination of Virginia should she expand into the West. Hence, the landless states appealed to a centralized government after independence as they had appealed to Great Britain before. Do not forget the Jay Gardocki Treaty, which was totally Federalist. They wanted to restrict the southern states from using the Mississippi River. This happened right before the Constitutional Convention. So, say again, Cal, I'm sorry.
That was in 1786, the Jay Gardocki Treaty, right?
Well, 1786, 1787, but the same theory was there.
Yes.
The New England moneyed people wanted to control the South. The South knew it. And that was probably the South being balking at this nationalization may have been the reason that the Articles of Confederation were written the way they were. The appeal was all the more effective because the leading politicians of the landless states were also their leading land speculators. Ho, imagine that. But the landed states defeated this effort to give Congress large powers, and for their further security, they added to the Articles of Confederation in their final form a provision to the effect that no state was to be deprived of its territory without its own consent. But yet that happens, and the Supreme Court ratifies it. The Supreme Court codifies it. The question of the basis of representation likewise involved the question of the nature of the government to be created. Was each state to have one vote in Congress, or were the states to be represented in Congress in proportion to their population or their wealth? What's your thoughts on that, Dave?
Well, it's hard to dispute. You know, Michael, you're bringing up a lot of interesting points right now. And it's funny how either people are willing to open their minds and look what the source documents actually say, or just believe what they've been told their entire lives. And it seems to be one or the other. Either people really get what you do, or people just can't handle it, and they figure you must not be telling the truth. There doesn't seem to be much in between.
Well, Dave, one of the things I was talking with some folks about that, when I do my programs in person, one of the first things I tell the crowd is don't believe a damn thing I say. And I challenge anybody else that you've heard teach you about the Constitution or anything, I guarantee you they won't say the same thing. Don't believe what I say, because if I give you a presentation, which happens to be my opinion, it could be anything. Research what I tell you. Go get the source documents and learn for yourself, because the knowledge you acquire for yourself will stay with you. The opinions of people who call themselves historians, whose college received a large government grant to write a book favoring the government's position. You know, I was talking with a friend about an author, just such an author, who is considered a foremost historian in America, Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R. Foner is considered to be the source in so many historical works. Eric Foner is an admitted Marxist.
Of course. Well, God, that's amazing. That makes sense, Mike. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is, you know, this whole concept of community standards with these platforms, you know, YouTube and Twitter and all this, Facebook. What it's really coming down to, there's no such thing as community standards. What it really is whether or not you contradict the official government narrative. If you contradict the official government narrative, you are violating community standards.
Yeah, but whose community? Theirs, not yours.
Right, exactly.
And that is why you have to look at Facebook, you have to look at YouTube, you have to look at these people as extensions, the very extensions of the government. Because basically YouTube and these other platforms are saying you cannot put up anything that is contradictory to what the government tells you. Authors, so-called historians, have been doing that for years. That was one of the things I had a professor tell me one time, and he had tenure, so he could pretty well get by with what he wanted to. And this, friends, was in the 60s. But he said, look at these professors who write these books that are half-truths, innuendos, and out-and-out lies. Look at their work and then go back and research the grants, the federal grants that went to their history departments. He said those were simply bribes. They tell the history department at Harvard University, okay, here's a $2.3 million draft. We need your professors to write some books which state false history, which supports the government. So they do it. So someone else picks up one of these books and reads it and takes it for the gospel truth because it was written in a book by a professor at Harvard University. It's just part of the psyop, guys. It's the same thing we're living through right now. And who was it? Mark Twain said, you know, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth can put on its shoes.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing that's so fascinating about your work, Mike, too, is it really shows that the same game was played back then that's being played now. It really hasn't changed much other than the scenery and the names that are occupying the seats of power.
Well, I've had members of my own family, Dave, ask me, why are you concerned with all this old stuff? And it's it's the same thing today. If you stepped in a trap, if you know where the traps are, if you know where the potholes are, you can avoid them. But if you're driving blind, if you don't know, as George Santayana said, those of us who fail to learn the lessons of history are destined to repeat its mistakes. And if people had been taught about these psychological operations that the Federalists were using to get this Constitution ratified, if they were thinking about that, if they were, you know, if they had known this had happened, they might be able to recognize it when they see it again. And that is part of the grand illusion. It's like everyone, every new generation is in virgin territory. History begins the day they were born. Nothing older than them makes any difference. And boy, are we looking at that one now. So, Cal, any comments on what the research that you did, something you want to throw out here? Don't let me take up the whole show.
Well, in doing my research and in dealing with the history that, you know, I was brought up with and taught, there were three major problems, supposedly, with the Articles of Confederation. And one, it couldn't preserve the Union. Two, it couldn't provide for the common defense. And three, it couldn't pay off the debts. And all three of those can be proven as wrong. First, preservation of the Union. Well, let's see what Hamilton himself had to say about the Union. And this comes from Hamilton in Federalist 23. And he says, this is explaining why we should take up this Constitution. He says, the necessity of a Constitution at least equal and energetic with the one proposed to the preservation of the Union is the point at the examination of what we would now arrive. And he goes in and he starts explaining about it. And he ends up the conversation in Federalist 23. He says, this, at all events, must be evident that the very difficulty itself, drawn from the extent of the country, is the strongest argument in favor of an energetic government. So for any other, certainly can never preserve a union so large of an empire. So he wasn't trying to create just a union to preserve a union. These Federalists were trying to create a new world empire or new world order modeled after what they wanted. That's what they were after back then.
Okay. Go ahead, Cal.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
Well, that would be the first thing. You know, the arguments was it could preserve the Union. The second of it is it wouldn't provide for the common defense. And you know, the most obvious thing is they just defeated the largest army on the face of the earth at the time, being the British government. And the third being it couldn't pay the debt. And as it said, the foreign debt was being paid. It was the domestic debt that was a problem. And that domestic debt was owed to the very Federalists that wrote the Constitution. So they wrote this so to make sure that they got paid. So everything, all three arguments that I've ever heard listed against the Articles of Confederation can be proven to be wrong.
Well, there's two things, Cal. Excellent point. There are two things that I want to bring up here before we run out of time. And one of them was we were told and we've heard over and over, which we've gone over, the disasters of economics and commerce, and they necessitated a departure from the Articles of Confederation and the adoption of an entirely new constitution of greater energy. That energy is to be used against the people. But we don't read it that way. But here are three statements that contradict that were made during this same time frame. And number one comes from George Washington. And he says, our internal state governments are daily acquiring strength. The laws have their fullest energy. Justice was well administered. Robbery, violence, or murder is not heard from New Hampshire to Georgia. The people at large are more industrious than they were before the war. Houses are rebuilt, fields enclosed, stocks of cattle which were destroyed have been replaced. The foundation of a great empire is laid, and Providence will not leave its goal imperfect. Really? If things were that good, George, why did you want a new constitution? Then let's go to Charles Thompson, who was the secretary to the Congress. And Charles Thompson, in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, said he would, and I quote, venture to assert there is not upon the face of the earth a body of people more happy or rising into consequence with more strides than the inhabitants of the United States of America, unquote. And then Robert Livingston, one of the strongest Federalists in New York, one of the richest families in New York, made this statement, and I quote, the best criterion for the state of trade is that the commodities and labors of the country still bear a better price than they did before the war, unquote. Here are three Federalists who said just the opposite of what they were telling the people. Now, these are in private documents, so you have to go to the source documents. You wouldn't know about them with the source documents. But greater than, well, I won't say greater, but at least let's look to the words of Patrick Henry at the Virginia Ratification Convention. When Patrick Henry said, commerce, riches, and wealth vanished, citizens going to seek comforts in other parts of the world, laws insulted, many instances of tyrannical legislation. These things, sir, are new to me. He has made the discovery as to the administration of justice. I believe that failures in commerce, etc., cannot be attributed to it. My age enables me to recollect its progress under the old government. I can justify it by saying that it continues in the same manner in this state as it did under the former government. As to other parts of the continent, I refer that to other gentlemen. As to the ability of those who administer the government, I believe they would not suffer by comparison with those who administered it under the royal authority. What is the cause of complaint if the wealthy go away? Is this added to the other circumstances of such enormity, and does it bring such danger over this commonwealth as to warrant so important and so powerful a change in so precipitate a manner? Then Patrick Henry continues, but what does this Constitution say? The clause under consideration gives an unlimited and unbounded power of taxation. Wow. He said here, talking about the Constitution now, Patrick Henry said, here is a revolution as radical as that which separated us from Great Britain. It is radical in this transition. Our rights and our privileges are endangered, and the sovereignty of the states will be relinquished, and cannot we plainly see this is the case? Will the abandonment of your most sacred rights tend to the security of your liberty? Liberty, the greatest of all earthly blessings, give us that precious jewel, and you may take everything else. But I am fearful I have lived long enough to become a fellow. Perhaps an invincible attachment to the dearest rights of man may in these refined, enlightened days be deemed old-fashioned. If so, I am contented to be so. I say the time has been when every pore of my heart beat for American liberty, and which, I believe, had a counterpart in the breast of every true American. But suspicions have gone forth. Suspicions of my integrity, publicly reported that my professions are not real. 23 years ago, I was supposed a traitor to my country. I was then said to be the bane of sedition because I supported the rights of my country. I may be thought suspicious when I say our privileges and rights are in danger now. There are many on the other side who possibly may have been persuaded of the necessity of these measures, which I conceive to be dangerous to your liberty. guard with jealous attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. Whenever you give up that force, you are inevitably ruined. I am answered by gentlemen that though I might speak of terrors, yet the fact was that we are surrounded by none of the dangers apprehended. I conceive this new government to be one of those dangers. It has produced those horrors which distress many of our best citizens. We are come hither to preserve the poor Commonwealth of Virginia, if it can be possibly done. Something must be done to preserve your liberty and mine. The Confederation, this same despised government, merits, in my opinion, the highest encomium. It carried us through a long and dangerous war. It rendered us victorious in that bloody conflict with a powerful nation. It has secured us a territory greater than any European monarch now possesses. And shall a government which has been thus strong and vigorous be accused of imbecility and abandoned for a want of energy? Instances of the people losing their liberty by their carelessness and the ambition of a few. We are cautioned by the honorable gentleman who presides against faction and turbulence. I acknowledge that licentiousness is dangerous and that it ought to be provided against. I acknowledge also the new form of government may effectually prevent it. Yet there is another thing it will as effectually do. It will oppress and ruin the people. There are sufficient guards placed against sedition and licentiousness. For when power is given to the government to suppress these, or for any other purpose, the language it assumes is clear, express, and unequivocal. But when this Constitution speaks of privileges, there is an ambiguity, sir, a fatal ambiguity, an ambiguity which is very astonishing. In some parts of the plan before you, the great rights of freemen are endangered, in other parts absolutely taken away. How does your trial by jury stand? In civil cases, gone. Not sufficiently secured in criminal. This best privilege is gone. But we are told that we need not fear because those in power, being our representatives, will not abuse the power we put in their hands. I am not well versed in history, but I will submit to your recollection whether liberty has been destroyed most often by the licentiousness of the people or by the tyranny of rulers. I imagine, sir, you will find the balance on the side of tyranny. I could go on and on with Mr. Henry, but Mr. Henry just absolutely nailed the door shut on the criminality of their enterprise, which produced a Constitution. What is amazing, and Cal has firsthand experience of this, are the charlatans out there who push the Constitution as the do-all to end-all, attribute Patrick Henry with having a hand in its development. Cal, you want to expound on that?
Are we talking about the sirenness of the Constitution herself?
Yeah, I would say you're probably correct. I don't like to use names, but you can use the phrase if you like.
She's the sirenist of the Constitution. She tickles the people's ears with her words and gets them to cling to this parchment, these scribbles on parchment, and to basically worship the document that's actually enslaving them. And you can point it out, and she'll use she's quite frequently tried to use Patrick Henry or Mercy Otis Warren as reasons as to why the Constitution and liberty equate with each other, which they don't. But yeah, it's fun. Some of the discussions.
Well, there's another guy who has made quite a bit of money making nice looking DVDs that he especially sells to the Christian community, who claims the same thing, who will say that Patrick Henry was, you know, a Christian who was so involved in the development of the Constitution. And again, people believe the lies because he has a nice flowery DVD with nice presentation and all of the stuff. And he is tickling their ears. Good phrase. I think that comes from Peter, doesn't it? Second Peter, First Peter? I'm not sure. But it comes from one or the other about tickling the ears. And that's what they're doing. But when these people use the people who oppose the Constitution totally, and none so strongly as Patrick Henry. And when that shows the ultimate effort for their delusion is to try to convince you that the people who oppose the Constitution actually supported it. When someone tells you that lie and you find it out, how can you believe anything else they've ever said? And to dress up like Mercy Otis Warren, who totally opposed the Constitution, and to dress up like Mercy Otis Warren claiming she supported the Constitution. But the thing that is amazing is that Americans will pay these people to lie to them, but they won't do their own research.
Well, I guess that guy that makes the DVDs didn't read the primary source document from Patrick Henry saying he'd rather, what, chop off his own hand than sign that document? Was that what it was?
Actually, that was George Mason. But
George Mason. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
But Patrick Henry wouldn't go to the Constitutional Convention because he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia.
Right, right.
So we've got, it still amazes me that people prefer the comfortable lie to the truth. I'm always amazed at that. It continues when it's right there. And, you know, you can look at the sources, and I'll be happy for everything that I've said today. Everything I've said comes from an original source. Be happy to provide those documents to anybody who wants them, or at least tell them where they can find them. Does any of these people who preach about the wonderness of the Constitution and how we have all these constitutional rights and all of these wonderful things, do they ever offer to back that up with source documentation? Do they ever mention the letters between the founders? And Cal, I believe there is probably no letter more exposing to the fraud of the Federalist than that letter from James Madison to Richard Peters. Would you agree?
Well, it would be that one or the one from Madison to Washington, where he says that his intent is to make the states subservient. His intent is to supersede the state constitutions. He lays out the power they want to grab and how they want to do it without the people knowing it.
And everyone in government today who is suppressing your liberty, who is not only suppressing it, but getting ready to take it from you, is using the Constitution that these Federalists wrote. Now, you know, I put a mime on Facebook this morning. I said, please point out to me the point where that gives Joe Biden the authority to do all of these executive orders. But more importantly, please show me the clause in the Constitution that prevents him from doing so. Well, we're getting up here to the end of time. Dave, you want to tell them about your show next week, buddy? Or tomorrow?
Sure. Tomorrow. Yeah. Tomorrow I'm going to have... the first hour will be, a fellow host here on Revolution Radio, Mr. Stephen Crawford. And we're just going to, talk about current events and what he's up to. And then we're going to have Vicki Davis on for the final hour. And she's been doing some deep research into this new international socialism that's a new system that's sort of being unveiled. And we're seeing it with the goals of the World Economic Forum and other things. So Vicky's a heavy duty researcher. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more of her findings on this new system they're trying to unveil to the great unwashed masses.
I'm looking forward to that as well, Dave. Sounds like a great program. Well, it looks like we're getting up close to the time. Folks, also, if you would tune in on Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern to Addicted to Your Own Destruction, where my friend D.W., my producer here, Dave Scorpio, and I will be bringing you the story of the Yazoo land deal. And when the Supreme Court of the United States said that bribing a legislature was fine as long as the Federalist land speculators made millions of dollars. So, and that was a long time ago, guys, over 200 years ago. That's your wonderful Constitution allowed that to happen. Allowed the Federalist land speculators to buy two states for 2 cents an acre. That should be an interesting show. What do you think, Dave?
Hey, that sounds like a great deal. Where do I sign up?
Well, you had to be a Federalist. You had to be in on the deal, just like Dr. Fauci has been in on the deal. You know, look how much money he's made.
Absolutely.
Well, looks like it's the end of the show. So, Cal, were you saying something very quickly?
Yeah, I was going to say, it wasn't that the Federalists allowed that, the Constitution allowed it to happen. The Constitution. So,
all right, folks, thanks for tuning in. Come back and see us next week. Have a great weekend.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero X E 0513. We talk about decentralization.